Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and this is what we call the Learning College. Today we are going to do Chapter 8 of David Kupelian's The Marketing of Evil, and it's going to talk about the media and how it creates a world of illusion. Now, Kupelian himself participates in that illusion creating, but earlier chapters in this book we've heard about selling gay rights to America. That's probably the best work in this book. We've heard about Kinsey and the creation of the sexual revolution based on bogus facts. We've heard about selling sex and rebellion to your kids in Chapter 3, multicultural madness, family meltdown, and easy divorce, and how that got started. Obsession with sex. Again, that's the Kinsey, how fraudulent science unleashed a catastrophic revolution. All these are recorded in audiobook segments at vnnforum.com, where everything that we do is located, and which you can read or even join the forum if you like. Today, as I say, we'll be doing Chapter 8, The Media Matrix, How the Press Creates a World of Illusion We Think is Real. And, you know, I'm reminded of a poll I saw just the other day that two out of three Republicans would put Israel ahead of the U.S. if their interests diverged. And that's exactly what Kupelian is talking about. It fits his theme perfectly, but it's something he would never say because he, per his boss Joe Farah, or Suck Poop Joe as we always called him, serve Israel. And they pretend that Israel is somehow holy and noble and the Jews are this wonderful, special people, the apple of God's eye. I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing in the world, but they believe that, and they pretend to believe that for profit. So when we talk about the media matrix, we are talking about WorldNet Daily as a very living, breathing part of that, part of the fake opposition to the ruling system, which it is the purpose of this book to give you some of the symptoms, but never the actual disease. Hence, the commentary we offer for our audiobooks gives you the meta message. We put not only what the person is saying in context, we put that person himself and the publication of this book and its intent in perspective. You always have to think about the motives of people who are, you don't just take anything handed to you and assume that the motives of the person producing it are on the up and up. That's unsophisticated and it's dangerous to yourself, even if it's in line with the foolish golden rule, treat others the way you would be treated yourself. But you don't want anyone doubting your motives, so you don't doubt their motives. But this only means that the people who do doubt motives, who think are quicker minded, are going to rule you. So they're setting you up to be a slave when they tell you not to doubt motives. You should doubt motives. It doesn't even make sense if they go around preaching on one hand that men are evil and they have wickedness in their hearts. But don't ever doubt their motives, though. Treat them the way you would want to be treated. What if they're not like you? Jews aren't like you. They look at things very differently, and it's a racial, tribal, genetic mindset. And as they are the ones who are controlling the media, the mass media, that's highly significant. But, of course, that's not what David Kupelian is going to tell you. Anyway, let's get started. When Ronald Reagan finally slipped away from this earthly life in June of 2004, most Americans were swept up in the week-long memorial full of poignancy and praise, eulogies and processions, stories and jokes, all sustained by a deep wellspring of love for the 40th president. Joining in the pageantry were all of the familiar stars of the news media. With Hail to the Chief trumpeting in the background, they memorialized Reagan's paramount role in ending the Cold War, his revitalization of America's stagnant economy after Jimmy Carter's malaise, his rekindling of Americans' faith in their country and its enduring values. And they took obvious pride in sharing stories of their personal experiences with the Gipper. It continued all week, gushing references to the great communicator, the shining city on the hill, morning in America, and Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, flowed effortlessly from the silver-tongued media orators, echoing the deepest sentiments of the vast majority of Americans. Yes, the big media loved Reagan in death, just as they reviled and mocked him in life. Here's what those same media icons were saying just a few short years ago at the end of Reagan's second term as president. Black quote. I predict historians are going to be totally baffled by how the American people fell in love with Ronald Reagan and followed him the way we did. CBS News reporter Leslie Stahl, January 11th, 1989. There's going to be about five or six more. Ronald Reagan presided over a meltdown of the federal government during the last 8 years. Fundamental management was abandoned in favor of rhetoric and imagery. A cynical disregard for the art of government led to wide-scale abuse. CBS News reporter Terrence Smith in the New York Times, November 4th, 1989. All these quotes are from 89. After Reagan leaving office. On behalf of the Nicaraguan Contras cause, Reagan sold out his oath of office and subverted the Constitution. Oliver North presented himself as the immortal boy in the heroic green uniform of Peter Pan. Although wishing to be seen as a humble patriot, the colonel's testimony showed him to be a treacherous and lying agent of the national security state, willing to do anything asked of him by a president to whom he granted the powers of an Oriental despot. PBS series America's Century, narrated by Harper's editor Lewis Lapham, November 28, 1989. 100 years from now, long after Reagan has been lumped with other ineffectual Dr. Feelgoods like William McKinley and Calvin Coolidge, who swam with the tide of their times, the last fourth of the 20th century will be remembered for the demise of imperial communism, and the Soviet Union's president will be remembered for both making and letting it happen. Boston Globe, Washington reporter and columnist Tom Oliphant, December 28, 1989. Ronald Reagan and Madonna. On the surface, he stood for fundamental American values that she parodied, but underneath they conveyed the same Horatio Alger myth, self-image over reality. Say it or sing it enough, and any dream you have of yourself might come true, at least in the public's perception. U.S. News and World Report, senior editor Donald Baer, December 25th, 1989. The 80s were the years of excess. We swaggered through the portals and grabbed as much as we could. We were greedy and gluttonous. As long as we wore starched shirts, we could belch at the dinner table, and Ronald Reagan let us. USA Today's Debbie Howlett, November 27th, 1989. The decade had its highs, Gorbachev, Byrd, and the decade had its lows. Reagan, AIDS, Boston Globe headlines over 80s reviews by the paper's columnist, December 28, 1989. Now, Kupelian, Reagan, AIDS, whoa, hit the pause button. The mainstream press hated Reagan, his values, his policies, and his influence on the nation. The nation, meanwhile, loved Reagan. What does this tell us? It tells us the so-called mainstream press is radically outside the mainstream. And that's actually a very good way to put it. There's a gigantic gap between public sentiment and the communist Jews who run the media. But this chapter is not about how the press is too biased or liberal or left-wing. That's old news, very old. Every objective study for the past three decades has proven conclusively the profound bias that is obvious to almost everyone. No, the scary fact is that the media, both news and entertainment, are literally the creators and sustainers of what most of us perceive as reality, reminiscent of the malevolent computer program in the Matrix film trilogy. In the Matrix, humans are born into a slave state in which what they think of as reality is actually a powerful computer-generated virtual reality program. They live in constant and deep delusion. Without realizing it, these humans have been reduced to the lowest form of servitude. Their life energy is literally sucked out of them to fuel the insatiable needs of their rulers. Wait a minute, you're probably thinking. I know the media are biased and out of touch with the mainstream, but what's this have to do with the Matrix? Let's find out. Black quote, or I'm sorry, new subtitle, Ready to Swallow the Red Pill. Remember the first moment when the hero, a young man named Neo, meets Morpheus for the first time? Morpheus is the leader of the tiny remnant of rebels who know the truth about the Matrix and are fighting to free mankind from its enslavers. Black quote, Morpheus, let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know, you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know quite what it is, but it's there. Like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about? Neo, the Matrix? Do you want to know what it is? Neo nods his head. The Matrix is everywhere. It's all around us, even now in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work or when you go to church or when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. The world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. What truth? That you were a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born inside a prison that you cannot smell, taste, or touch. A prison for your mind. Long pause, sighs. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. In his left hand, Morpheus shows a blue pill. You take the blue pill and the story ends. You awake in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. A red pill is shown in his other hand. You take the red pill and you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Long pause. Neo begins to reach for the red pill. Remember, all I am offering is the truth, nothing more. Neo takes the red pill and swallows it with a glass of water. Subtitle, A Prison for Your Mind. Everyone has heard, says Kupelian, about mass manipulation, mind control, brainwashing, suggestion, hypnosis, and Pavlovian conditioning. The scary stuff of far-off communist operatives, religious cults, and movie thrillers like The Manchurian Candidate. It pops up in the news now and then, as when the Symbionese Liberation Army kidnapped and brainwashed Patricia I Am Tanya Hearst, or more recently in Stockholm Syndrome cases where terrified hostages come to sympathize, and in some cases actually fall in love, with the terrorists threatening their lives. Nevertheless, we're never quite sure how much of this mind control stuff is objectively real and how much is just psychobabble or science fiction, right? The truth is, if we look at it closely enough, we'll discover it's not only real, but it's the fabric of our lives. To demonstrate real-life matrix programming, we consider our reality. Let's momentarily set aside the news media and focus on one of the most stunning and powerful matrix programs currently running. I'm referring to evolution. In the days prior to the evolution matrix program, that is, from the beginning of human life until Charles Darwin came along in the mid-19th century, human beings would step outside their homes and survey with their eyes and minds the wonders of nature. They'd see majestic 400-year-old redwood trees, hummingbirds that were able to hover, and honeybees that somehow knew to do a special figure-eight dance that would communicate to the other worker bees the precise location of the dancer's newly discovered nectar source. Looking in every direction, we humans beheld not only fantastic complexity, diversity, and order, but also the supreme intelligence behind creation, as brashly evident and unavoidable as the noonday sun. This ubiquitous natural wonderland caused man to acknowledge and honor the creator of creation, as Nicholas Copernicus did when he wrote, quote, "The world has been built for us by the best and most orderly workman of all." Or, as Galileo wrote, "God is known by his nature in his works, and by his doctrine in his revealed word." Or as Louis Pasteur confessed, "The more I study nature, the more I stand amazed at the work of the Creator." Or Isaac Newton, "When I look at the solar system, I see the Earth at the right distance from the sun to receive the proper amounts of heat and light. This did not happen by chance." Did not happen by chance? Ever since Darwin and his successors succeeded in loading the evolution matrix program on mankind, a fantastic theory for which there is no actual proof and many serious problems, when we now walk outside and look at the created universe, what do so many of us see? Chance. Although our eyes survey the same wonders of God's creation that inspired faith in our forefathers, in our minds today we see only the meaningless result of millions of years of random chance mutation. That's what our minds see, the eternal dance of purposeless recombination of ever more complex forms, but all without meaning, without spirit, without love. And by direct implication, we also see that man is not a fallen being needful of God's saving grace, but merely the cleverest, most evolved of all animals. And since evolution, by definition, always results in improvement and advancement, all of man's violent, lustful, and selfish drives are perfectly normal and natural. And advanced. There is no good and evil, no heaven and hell, and man, as a highly evolved monkey, has no sin and no guilt, as these are logical impossibilities from the evolutionary point of view. Get the idea? And that's just one real-life matrix program. Our eyes and our senses work just fine, but we've been lied to so thoroughly and consistently that we no longer perceive the meaning of what we see nor understand what we hear. Now let's turn our attention to the news media and examine some of the interesting programs currently running. Next subtitle, Who Should Be President? Let's not talk about media. Let's talk about media bias here. The media, I think, want John Kerry to win. That was Newsweek's Evan Thomas candidly admitting the obvious on PBS's Inside Washington. In fact, during the 2004 Democratic convention, New York Times columnist John Tierney asked 153 journalists whether they thought John Kerry or George W. Bush would make a better president. Reporters from outside the Beltway favored Kerry 3-1, while the approximately 50 Washington-based journalists polled favored Kerry over Bush by a stunning 12-1 margin. The bias, of course, reached absurd levels when Dan Rather and CBS News pathetically stonewalled the entire world, even the rest of the mainstream media, arrogantly defending the obviously bogus documents Rather and 60 Minutes had featured for the intended purpose of bringing down a U.S. president. But that was just the time they got caught. What about the other thousands of news stories that form the fabric of confusion, spin, and deceit that passes for political analysis in the establishment press? The net result of this syndrome, as regards the 2004 election, is that somehow the truth about John Kerry never took root in the public mind. Let's unplug the Kerry, and again, this book is written in 2005, so that's why they're talking about Kerry. Let's unplug the Kerry Matrix program for a few minutes and look with real eyes at the man who was almost elected to the most powerful position in the world. Kerry told Americans he believes human life begins at conception, but he supports unrestricted abortion on demand up until the very moment of birth, opposes bans on the horrific partial birth abortion procedure, and opposes parental notification laws. Kerry said he wanted to balance the budget, but he had opposed a balanced budget amendment 5 times. Kerry said he'd cut taxes on working people, but he has a long record of supporting tax increases and opposing tax cuts. Kerry said he would make a stronger America and win the war on terror, but he is profoundly anti-military, having voted for at least 7 major reductions in defense and military spending. Kerry said he opposes same-sex marriage, but he was one of only 14 senators to vote against the Defense of Marriage Act, which was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. These impossible contradictions are all easily proved. There's Kerry's Senate voting record, and yet the public never heard of them, because the press, which Kerry wanted to win, wouldn't report the truth, at least so it would sink in. And again, Kerry discovered that he was a Jew from people named Cohn. And that's something that Kupelian himself won't tell you as part of his media fabric of confusion, distortion, spin, and whatever the opposite of revelation is, cover-up. Kerry made his 4-month tour of duty in Vietnam the centerpiece of his campaign, but the best-selling book, Unfit for Command, giving voice to dozens of decorated Vietnam vets who served alongside Kerry, painted a grotesquely disturbing picture of a budding sociopath. Overwhelmingly, Kerry's Vietnam colleagues portrayed him, writes columnist David Limbaugh, Rush's brother, as a ruthless, self-promoting egomaniac who systematically placed his own interests above his fellow soldiers, and who was obsessively involved in building his resume at all costs during the entirety of his short tour in Vietnam. Author John O'Neill, Limbaugh added, depicts Kerry, with mountains of documented evidence, as a pathological, unconscionable liar whose penchant for dishonesty in Vietnam was only exceeded by his brutal, unmitigated slander of his fellow soldiers when he rushed stateside to lobby against them, their superiors, and the entire military establishment. So, as with other Jews, he's a liar. That's his nature. And Kupelian, in serving the Jews, won't tell you that he's a liar, so he only opposes him as a typical liberal. In sum, John Kerry was a fraud whose election as president would have caused incalculable national harm. It was only the combined testimony of Swift Boat vets, scores of bona fide war heroes who were actually there in Vietnam with John Kerry and knew the truth, that ultimately persuaded the public, despite the media's pro-Kerry spin, that the Massachusetts senator was unfit for command. So where were the media? Same place they were when Bill Clinton was allegedly trading sensitive weapons technology to the communist Chinese in return for campaign contributions. When they learned he was having a sexual affair in the Oval Office with a woman barely older than his own daughter. When a credible allegation of forcible rape was made public. When he was subverting America's intelligence capability that later allowed 9-1-1 to happen. When he committed outrage after impeachable outrage right under the media's noses. The press looked the other way. You see, corruption and even criminality on the part of a candidate don't matter with the establishment media nearly as much as that candidate's support for legalized abortion on demand, the activist homosexual agenda, and the rest of the secular big government agenda. Indeed, the press today share none of the concern and skepticism the Founding Fathers had over government. Rather, the media, and because of them a good deal of the population, have come to look at government as the primary problem solvers. This is simply because the more God diminishes in our lives, the more government has to rise to take his place. As William Penn said, men must be governed by God, or they will be ruled by tyrants. Thus, the media always tend to favor the Democratic Party and big government solutions to all problems, precisely because God isn't real to them. Please don't tell me some of them go to church or that this one's a Catholic or some other nonsense. I'm saying that when people have a real moment-to-moment relationship, with fear and trembling, as the good book says, with the living God, they do not look to government to solve all of their problems. One detrimental result of having such a subversive press is that it generates a subtle but powerful pressure on the president and other leaders. Put yourself in the president's place. You're basically always surrounded by the press corps, professional on the surface but secretly hostile to you, and in fact hostile to the foundational values underlying Western civilization. They're watching every move you make, recording every word that comes out of your mouth, looking for ways to undermine you. Remember, they wanted someone else to win the office you hold. Now, the best example he could use here would be Nixon. And the best example of that he could use would be Nixon talking to Billy Graham, because he'd have a double threat, the leader of America's Protestants, or a large portion of them, and the leader of literally the nation, agreeing that Jews have a stranglehold in America and America's going down the drain because of it. But Kupelian, being gutless and Jew servile, won't ever mention that, even though it's far stronger than any silly little stuff he can dredge up about how the media didn't like Reagan. Clearly, this dynamic exerts a powerful subconscious pressure on the president and other leaders to please the media and thus to bow to the agenda championed by the media. After all, the media determine what much of the public will see, hear, and think about the issues of the day and about the president himself. Any president obviously wants the public's approval of what he is doing, otherwise he can't be re-elected, and this depends to a significant extent on his favorable portrayal by the press. Thus, there is a constant and powerful pressure on elected leaders to bend, to compromise their principles, and to betray the public trust, fearing that not only that not to do so will result in disastrously negative media coverage and their ultimate defeat. Why did candidate George W. Bush come up with a budget-busting prescription drug benefit program before the 2000 election? Because candidate Al Gore had promised a budget-busting prescription drug benefit program, and the media made the public feel that any candidate who didn't offer a prescription drug benefit program hated old people and shouldn't be elected president. Honest reporting would have relieved Bush of the election year pressure to mirror Gore's vote-buying giveaway promises. In short, politicians always have the temptation to abandon their principles and fall to corruption in any of a thousand ways. The media, if they were doing their job, would not only keep politicians honest through watchdog reporting, but would also reduce leaders' temptation to stray from the Constitution by not making evil and corruption look so reasonable and attractive, and by not making the Constitution and biblical principles look so unfair and mean-spirited. But it gets much worse. Let's follow the trail down the rabbit hole and see how deep it goes. Subtitle is, Israeli Goliath Threatens Arab David. One of the most spectacular virtual reality mass illusions in the world today, reinforced constantly by the news media, is the perception that in the never-ending Arab-Israeli conflict, Israel is the evil aggressor, Goliath threatening the righteous but powerless Arab David. How is this possible? Israel, a sliver of a country the size of New Jersey, is surrounded by 22 Arab nations with vastly more population, land, wealth, armies, and oil. He doesn't say nuclear weapons, I notice. Israel has been attacked by its Arab neighbors 5 times in all, all-out wars of intended annihilation. The first war coming one day after Israel's founding in 19... How did Israel found itself? By aggression, of course. That doesn't count, though. The guy's a complete and utter hypocrite. He's doing exactly what he's preaching about. To this day, Israel is obligated to continually defend itself in a perpetual state of war declared by hostile neighbor nations, openly sworn to destroy it, as well as constant terrorist attacks on innocent civilians by jihadist suicide bombers. Of course, who started the modern suicide bombing? Why, or not suicide, but terrorist bombing? Was Israel blowing up the King David Hotel? And also attacking the British who ruled Palestine at that point. Assassinating them. To regard the tiny Jewish state as the aggressor in the Arab-Israeli conflict, then, is delusional. Well, not really, since they're bombing and murdering people around the clock. It's like putting a 7-year-old in the ring with a heavyweight boxer. I mean, where did Israel get its weapons? Israel doesn't allow inspection of its nuclear weapons while demanding that no other Arab state possess any. Israel is the one. If Israel is so powerless, how is it drawing tens of millions of dollars out of the American treasury daily? Daily. Unlike the other Arab states, except for maybe one, which is only receiving money in order purely because of the Israel relation and connection. You want to talk about a matrix and the belief that Israel runs America is something that is a matrix that Kupelian is part of and is sustaining. Even as he talks about a matrix he's revealing. Here's how this illusion is accomplished. Arab leaders, many of whom have from the start vowed to eliminate the Jewish state from the Middle East, have conspired to attain by guile and deceit what their militaries could not accomplish through repeated wars of aggression. They have cultivated a campaign to establish a Palestinian state directly on top of a vanquished Israel, like the state that was there before Israel was created. The Palestinian cause is a modern-day myth, broadcast and reinforced endlessly by the news media. The Palestinian state is the Trojan horse of the Arab world, designed to get inside Israel by way of deception and promises of peace. The Palestinian leadership doesn't want peace with Israel, it wants Israel. Like the Palestinian leadership, the other leaders of the Arab world care nothing for the Arab people who call themselves Palestinians. They care only for the destruction of Israel, which they hope the Palestinian cause will ultimately bring. As President Jimmy Carter confessed at a 1979 press conference, "I have never met an Arab leader that in private professed a desire for an independent Palestinian state. Publicly, they all espouse an independent Palestinian state." Let's pull on just one thread in the fabric of the Palestinian cause and see what happens. Remember the martyrdom of 12-year-old Mohammed al-Dura? It's a classic example of the media matrix. The world was horrified as news broadcasts played the sensational video footage over and over again of the Palestinian boy being shot on September 30th, 2000, apparently by Israeli forces, and then dying pitifully in his father's arms. Heart-wrenching photos of the father and son in a death grip, his son in death's grip, became immortalized in posters that were plastered up and down the streets of the West Bank and Gaza, inspiring many a youthful suicide bomber to join Muhammad in martyr's paradise. He became the poster boy and rallying cry of the bloody intifada that claimed hundreds of lives. Although the Israeli military initially assumed responsibility for the incident, it soon became apparent that the Israelis could not have shot the boy due to the large barrier between the Israeli military outpost across the remote junction in Gaza and the position of the boy and his father. In 2003, an independent journalistic investigation concluded that the al-Dura affair was actually a piece of Palestinian street theater, similar to the dramatic Palestinian funeral processions that were observed after the Israeli incursion into the Jenin refugee camp. During that public spectacle, a martyred corpse twice fell off the stretcher, only to hop back up and retake its place in the procession. The Palestinians had claimed 3,000 deaths in Jenin. The actual toll turned out to be 52. It turns out many Palestinians were playing to the camera on the day Mohammed al-Dura was martyred. Israeli commentator Amnon Lord's account of the larger scene at Netzarim Junction when the boy was supposedly shot to death, describes, quote, incongruous battle scenes complete with wounded combatants and screeching ambulances played out in front of an audience of laughing onlookers while makeshift movie directors do retakes of botched scenes. Palestinian journalists, what he could say if you were actually trying to reveal is the Palestinians are trying in their own crude way to come up with their own media twist to compete with a monolithic worldwide global Jewish network that justifies everything that the Jews do, no matter how vicious and violent. It's not like Kupelian could honestly argue that the Jews don't murder and torture Palestinian children daily, because they do. Palestinian journalist Sami El-Soudi echoes Lord's observation, revealing that, quote, almost all Palestinian directors take part more or less voluntarily in these war commissions, under the official pretext that we should use all possible means, including trickery and fabulation, to fight against the tanks and airplanes the enemy has and we don't, which, as Kupelian won't tell you, all come from America, out of your tax pockets. Who is Kupelian trying to fool? The idiots who read WorldNet Daily, basically. Our official press reported 300 wounded and dead at Netzarim Junction the day when Mohammed was supposedly killed. Most of the cameramen there were Palestinians. They willingly took part in the masquerade, filming fictional scenes, believing they were doing it out of patriotism. When a scene was well done, the onlookers laughed and applauded. It is incredible, says French journalist Gerard Hubert. You want to wonder if he's a Jew. How many people were calmly filming the Battle of Netzarim on September 30th, 2000? Not only professionals, some of them standing no more than 10 meters away from the Al-Dura incident, but amateurs as well. The rushes of video clips are full of surprising incongruities. Children smile as ambulances go by. A wounded Palestinian collapses, and 2 seconds later an ambulance pulls up to take him to the hospital. It looks as if the driver had been cued in, knew in advance where the Palestinian was going to fall, or was waiting in the upper right-hand corner just out of the photographic field, ready to zoom in on signal. Street theater. The Mohammed Al-Dura story, which, rather than documenting Israeli brutality toward Palestinians, shows instead the Arab propaganda machine being enabled, magnified, and laundered by the mainstream press, is but one story. There are hundreds and hundreds of similar shabby episodes, from the Jenin massacre to the, quote, murder, unquote, he puts that in quotes, of Rachel Corrie. That's a good example of this supposed American putting the murder of an American. He doesn't care. He sides with the Israelis when they murder Americans. Just like the Republicans we mentioned at the top of the show, two-thirds of whom, if our interests diverged, would side with Israel against America. That's how disloyal they are. That together create and reinforce this preposterous virtual reality illusion of Israel as the aggressor. Well, there's nothing elusive about it at all. It's very real to anyone who lives around them. They go into Iran and Iraq and murder their scientists. They produce 9-1-1 in order to get America into a Middle Eastern war to destroy Iraq and then to destroy Afghanistan and then to destroy Iran, hopefully. They create lies in order to get Syria destroyed, in order to destroy Libya. So, yeah, they are the aggressors. And they're taking money out of your white pockets every day of the year while bragging about how rich and independent and brilliant and genius-filled they are. That's how Jews operate. And Kupelian is part of their lying matrix. So he's doing exactly the thing he's purporting to discover or uncover and unveil. Kupelian and WorldNet Daily and Joe Farah, his boss, are part of the matrix for fooling right-wing people. The truth is, the Palestinian cause is itself a giant piece of street theater, just as the separate scenes, Mohammed Al-Dura's martyrdom, children being told they'll go to heaven if they commit mass murder, leaders like the late Yasser Arafat pretending to seek peace with Israel, in English, while simultaneously urging violent jihad, in Arabic, are the little charades that comprise the whole. It takes an incredible amount of effort. See, of course, there's no discussion at all about how Israel was established, violently, over the people who already lived there. It takes an incredible amount of effort and energy on the part of the news media to maintain such an obviously outrageous suspension of reality. But what would happen if the press reported accurately, objectively, and courageously on the Middle East conflict? Media reports would reflect truthfully that Israel is a Western democracy surrounded by dozens of backward, repressive, terror-supporting Arab police states dedicated to Israel's annihilation. They'd show the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Arafat was the father of modern terrorism. No, it was actually the Jews and Irgun, the Stern Gang. They'd show the so-called Palestinian problem was cynically created for the precise purpose of eliminating the Jewish state by deception. The media would reveal that the Palestinian leadership is not now, nor has ever been, interested in a separate Palestinian state next to Israel, but rather in taking over all of Israel. Well, what about the West Bank, you say? Doesn't that belong rightfully to the Palestinians? When did it belong to the Palestinians? Before 1967, when Israel seized it in an unprovoked war of intended annihilation launched by neighboring Arab nations, the West Bank was part of Jordan. So whence comes this idea that it belonged to the Palestinians? It's a myth, a lie, a matrix program created in the Arab Middle East and presented endlessly by the Western press as though it were reality. Why does he even care about this anyway? I mean, what relation does any of this have to do with America? It's just that it has none, really. And if it had any, it would be, how do we detach ourselves from this Jewish parasite? It's rather his concern, and WorldNet Daily's true concern is Israel and the Jews, not America. They're just selling this dope to moronic right-wingers. Pedophile priests and Boy Scouts. We've seen in the preceding examples just how flagrant the media's distortion of reality can get. Now consider how subtle it can get. Let's focus for a few moments on one of the most sensational news stories of recent years. The Catholic Church's clergy sex scandal, usually identified by the ubiquitous news tag, pedophile priest. It's a great headline, short, punchy, and with that nice double P alliteration. The only problem is it's not true. It turns out the vast majority of the offending priest's misdeeds do not involve pedophilia, sexual contact between an adult and a prepubescent youth. Rather, they amount to sexual seductions of teenage boys by predatory homosexual men who have abused their position of authority and trust. Stephen Rubino, a lawyer who has represented more than 300 alleged victims of priest abuse, estimates that 85% of the victims have been teenage boys, according to National Review's Rod Dreher. If you recall, the American press was white-hot in exposing the Catholic hierarchy's inexcusable toleration of known sex offenders, transferring them to other posts and generally looking the other way rather than reporting their crimes to the police, ejecting them out of the clergy and into jail. Yet a horrendous hypocrisy accompanied the media's coverage of pedophile priests. You see, there's been another major ongoing news story involving homosexuality, namely the controversy over the discriminatory policies of the Boy Scouts of America, and now 10 years later they accept homosexuals as Cub Scout leaders. For several years now, many American organizations and corporations have withdrawn their financial and moral support from the Boy Scouts and condemned the organization as prejudiced and bigoted. At least 50 United Way chapters have ceased to fund the Boy Scouts. Some local governments and school districts have declared it to be discriminatory, and the ACLU attacks it endlessly. And what did the century-old Boy Scouts of America, one of the most beloved and beneficial organizations in history, having helped lead tens of millions of boys into responsible adulthood, do to deserve this vilification? Just this. Unlike the Catholic Church in America, the scouting organization doesn't knowingly allow homosexual men to hold official positions of trust and authority over young males. Indeed, historically, the Boy Scouts of America has had its own problem with sexual offenses committed by adult leaders against scouts, so serious that prevention has become a major preoccupation, with constant leader screening and training, the too-deep leadership requirement, and programs for scouts to identify warning signs of inappropriate advances by adults. The scouting folks understand the undeniable reality that Adults interested in sexual contact with young people gravitate toward careers and volunteer positions, allowing proximity to their prey, positions such as coaches, teachers, scoutmasters, and priests. The scouts simply refuse to allow what the Catholic Church has allowed, letting known homosexuals occupy positions of authority and trust, positions too easily and too often used to prey on vulnerable young people. So the big question, why does the mainstream press condemn the Catholic Church for allowing predatory homosexuals to destroy the lives of boys, while simultaneously condemning the Boy Scouts of America for trying to avoid precisely the same thing in their organization? What? You don't see the media condemning the Boy Scouts? Remember, I said subtle. The press provides widespread and sympathetic journalistic voice to the absurd arguments and campaigns of those reviling the Scouts, cutting off their funding, and portraying them as a hateful, discriminatory organization. Without this media cheerleading, the shrill condemnations of radical homosexuals and ACLU lawyers would be seen for what they are, shameful attempts to destroy one of the most positive institutions America has ever known. Today's mainstream news organizations, which, as we have seen, include a considerable number of agenda-driven homosexuals, he'll mention the homos in the media, but not the Jews. Because he should know, he does know, because he's read E. Michael Jones about the Frankfurt School's attempt to destroy the white race by promoting homosexuality and promiscuity. He's aware of that connection, but he's afraid to mention the Jews because he's taking their side for money. But he's willing to mention homos. Today's mainstream news organizations, which as we have seen include a considerable number of agenda-driven homosexuals who cynically regard the press as just a powerful activist tool, are quick to reflect the gay rights movement's condemnation of the Boy Scouts organization and the Catholic Church, both of which officially oppose homosexuality. The only problem for pro-gay rights journalists is, how do you get around the fact that it's none other than smooth-talking, predatory homosexuals who are the cause of the problems within the both Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts of America? No problem. Just call the homosexual priests pedophiles, which they are not. That takes the spotlight off homosexuality. Okay, let me read this paragraph again. Just call the homosexual priests pedophiles, which they are not. That takes the spotlight off of homosexuality and simultaneously pretend there is no connection between the issue of allowing homos to become adult scout leaders and the very real problem of homosexual scout leaders molesting scouts. That is the schizophrenic manner in which the media played both stories, and thus with great subtlety they have advanced the gay rights agenda by protecting it from some very bad publicity. Okay, you might be saying. So you're picking out a few horror stories where the media got it wrong. What's the point? These are not horror stories. They're normal. They are the very fabric of the daily news coverage churned out by today's journalism organizations. Throughout this book, from gay rights to multiculturalism to sexual liberation, we've seen at every turn the central role the news media played in selling radical agendas to Americans. Gay rights, abortion rights, gun control, hate crimes, separation of church and state. Behind these and other facile news labels are what amount to virtual reality constructs, sophisticated marketing products composed of lies and truth, seamlessly sewn together. Poke at them a little and they burst, spilling out marketing slogans, half-truths, emotionalized reasoning, distortions, and bald-faced lies. Whatever the focus, today's so-called mainstream news coverage is rooted in a powerfully propagandistic impulses and results in a web of matrix-like delusions, which most of us think is the real world. What's behind the media matrix? Now, do you think he's going to mention Jews owning? The media are concentrated and they're in the hands of people who hate normal whites and Christians. Jews. You think he'll say anything that simple? Of course he won't. What's behind the media matrix is the next subtitle, second to last in this chapter. In truth, propagandists within the news media, just like all the other marketers of evil discussed in this book, in other words, the authority class the average person looks to for experts and role models, are themselves pawns in a great cosmic game of deception. In a very real sense, they're also caught up in and subject to a matrix program, but one that's been running not only during this generation, but in one way or another for as long as man has been around. And this real-world matrix is every bit as powerful consuming, and seemingly inescapable as that in the science fiction thriller. Of course, I'm talking about evil, the real matrix of deception in this world, the dark spiritual dimension that waits upon the human race to tempt and ensnare as many of us as possible. Evil approaches each of us mainly through other people who typically don't realize the role they're playing in leading us astray. One need only think of a 14-year-old boy seducing a 13-year-old girl to get this concept. He doesn't realize the harm he's doing to both of them. Indeed, most of us, from the time we're born, are pressured at one time or another by parents, family, friends, teachers, employers, and the larger culture to become something other than what the good Lord intended us to become, with the promise of reward and/or the threat of punishment through intimidation, false love, cruelty, seduction, and endless other ways people appeal to the various hidden weaknesses in all of us. Our lives are shaped and molded by outside influences. In a sense, I'm describing the very machinery of life within the matrix that all of us, even the most decent and noble, get caught up in to one degree or another. And one can almost hear, is he basically saying, yeah, I'm an evil tool of the Jews, but, you know, that's just how the world works, and I'm weak, and we're all weak, and we're all caught up in it one way or another. Who knows? But this life also causes us to suffer, and it is that very suffering that prompts us to desire to be free of the matrix of evil. Although some people descend into loving the matrix, others are not at all happy living there, and like Neo, yearn to be free. If that sounds far-fetched, consider 20th century history. We've all seen how many people living under communist or Nazi propaganda succumbed to the lies of totalitarianism. Some even reveled in it, rising to become leaders, and yet other people resisted the lie even unto death. We should never underestimate the power of appeals to the dark impulses of human nature. Consider a current example of this kind of extreme matrix programming. In some parts of the Islamic world, children are bred and nurtured for what they are taught is their highest purpose, attaching explosives to their God-given bodies and vaporizing themselves, while they take with them as many innocent people as possible, all in the insane belief that they are thereby earning their way into heaven. The thoughts, feelings, and beliefs of such youngsters are not their own thoughts, feelings, and beliefs. Rather, they have been cruelly injected into them by means of the sort of brainwashing techniques that have been used by cult leaders like Charles Manson and Jim Jones. Powerful emotions of hatred, false love, pride, and envy, lying philosophies about who God is and how to please Him, all tend to appeal to the victim's lower nature. The brainwashers' best ally in this conversion process. Indeed, what Christianity calls pride and psychology calls ego is full of weaknesses that can be easily exploited. See, why is he so obsessed with this? Who cares about any of this? It's only of relevance to Israel, his bosses. It has very little relevance to anyone in America who's presumably reading this book or going to buy it. The jihadist child's desire for glory and his mortal fear of shaming his family. Remember, the sick subculture he lives in literally revolves around honor and shame, not right and wrong, can be played like a musical instrument by a skillful manipulator, desiring to implant hatred and call it forth to action. Whether you call it conditioning, programming, or mind control, you must admit that, whatever it is, it must be very strong to induce young people to overcome their own natural desire to live, to have a family, to be happy. Don't think for a minute that this dynamic of being programmed by others only occurs in far-off lands. It goes on right here in the good old USA, in your state, in your town, perhaps in your home. Of course, for most of us, particularly in America, the pressures are usually less obvious than they are for those living under horrendous isms like communism and radical Islamism. But the principles are exactly the same. Pick a behavior, say body piercing. Do you really think millions of people independently arrived at the idea that it's a great thing to bore holes in multiple parts of their bodies? I'm not talking about earrings and embed metal objects there. Obviously, people do this because they see others doing it, and yet somehow they still believe it's their own idea. No one likes to think he or she has a weak mind and is acting out the suggestion of other people. But here's the key point about being influenced and shaped by peer pressure. If you're unwilling to recognize there's something wrong with your programming, with the way you think and act and feel, that means you're firmly in its grip. But if you are more self-aware, if you're introspective and sincere enough to recognize there's something wrong with the way you were living, then you can break out of the peer pressure matrix. God rewards honest people, those who are willing to give up the lie, no matter how painful that is or how damaging to our pride. But since we all seem to have this part of our nature that is somehow more inclined to believe flattering con men than prophets telling us painful truths, it's essential that our nation's culture revolve around reality. That's what true civilization is. A culture that affirms good is good and evil is evil acts as a mirror of sorts, helping each of us keep a firm grip on private and public morality. A well-known Bible verse says, "Woe unto them that call evil good, and good evil, that put darkness for light, and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet, and sweet for bitter." Indeed, this book is about how evil is packaged and perfumed to look good, and good made to appear evil. Unfortunately, today's establishment press, the primary filter through which we receive most of our information about the world, does not revolve around reality. As a matter of fact, over the past few decades, no institution has been more culpable for making evil appear good and good appear evil than the media. Well, gee, Davy, who owns the media? Who determines what goes out over the airwaves? Little Davy, he said he was taking us down the rabbit hole, but he doesn't appear interested in asking that question, let alone answering it, because that would implicate him in the great deception called The Matrix. Last subtitle. The evil of the age. Hiding behind the pretense of journalistic impartiality, de facto activists masquerading as objective, dispassionate reporters use the same seductions, the same expert packaging of corruption, the same propaganda techniques that professional marketers use. In America, what was once a free press, the hallmark of a free country, has largely become just another public relations establishment intent on advancing ideologies and agendas that are hostile to traditional American values. For the ultimate case in point, in the next chapter, we'll take an in-depth look at the most shocking and dishonest public relations crusade of all, namely the campaign to legalize abortion. Make no mistake, it is because of the news media that abortion destroys more than 1 million lives in America every year. Most members of the establishment press want abortion to be legal, and that is why it is legal. But what would happen if today's news media were to report accurately, objectively, and courageously on abortion, as the New York Times did way back in the 1870s when it headlined its groundbreaking investigative series on abortion in New York, The Evil of the Age? Of course, he won't tell you that was before the Jews owned it, in 1870. What if reporters and editors cut through the high-flying rhetoric of civil rights and constitutional freedom and women's health and brought the issue down to little, perfectly formed human babies, 3,000 of them every day, the same number of people as perished on 911, being painfully ripped apart, suctioned, chemically burned or sliced up, or decapitated? What if the press diligently reported on the proven and devastating physical and psychological effects abortion has on women, or on the many studies that show abortion leads to an increased risk of breast cancer? What if the press actually broadcast pictures or videos of abortions? What if the press reported not just once, equivocally and in subdued tones, as it is prone to do with facts it doesn't like, but feels obligated to report, but aggressively and relentlessly with saturation coverage, as today's New York Times did with dozens upon dozens of front-page stories on the Abu Ghraib prison scandal? I think he misspelled that. Can there be any doubt as to the result? Americans would see the truth once again, and the realization of the horror of abortion would, as it did for centuries before this generation, seep into and eventually permeate the public consciousness. Abortion would not only become illegal once again, but would widely be recognized as grossly immoral, barbaric, and criminal. Are you ready? It's time to unplug the abortion matrix program. That we will handle in Chapter 9. So that's the end of Chapter 8 about media deception, and nowhere does he talk at all about race and diversity, which you'd think might be his best examples, but that would lead him to the real motive of the real types running the media, and he won't come anywhere near that. Anyway, thanks for listening to me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.